The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org. It's now my pleasure to welcome our guests. An acclaimed novelist and the child of Trinidadian immigrants, Lauren Frances Sharma has written about the Caribbean in both of her books. Her debut, Till the Well Runs Dry, tells the multi-generational saga of a sharp-tongued Trinidadian seamstress's travails and bittersweet triumphs. The book was shortlisted for the William Saroyan International Prize and was one of O Magazine's 10 titles to pick up now. Her new novel, The Book of the Little Axe, was described by award-winning novelist Laura Vandenberg as epic in ambition and scope, a sweeping tale that illuminates her characters and their tangled histories and brings them to life with tremendous precision and sensitivity. This is a work of a major voice, a brilliant talent. Lauren is also the McDowell Colony Fellow and the Assistant Director of the Breadloaf Writers Conference. Tonight, she'll be in conversation with a friend of the library, Erica Armstrong Dunbar, National Director of the Association of Black Women Historians, and the award-winning author of Never Caught, The Washington's Relentless Pursuit of Their Runaway Slave, Ona Judge, and She Came to Slay, The Life and Times of Harriet Tubman. Erica and Lauren, the screen is all yours.
Thank you. Wonderful. Thank you so much for the introduction. Hello to everyone who I can't see, but I know you're there. Thank you so much. Let me sort of actually begin with thanking the Free Library for its commitment to quality programming and to public events during this super challenging time. And I thank all of you who are at home, maybe in your pajamas, maybe in something with buttons on it. But thank you for joining with us this evening, for tuning in on a Thursday to spend some time with us. And so a couple of days ago, I wrote on social media that I lost sleep while I was reading this book, that I simply couldn't put it down. And so I want to thank you, Lauren, first, for this sort of timely, necessary, beautiful distraction from what's around us right now. Now, in just full disclosure, Lauren and I have known each other for some time. We actually go back, we were college classmates at Penn, go Quakers. So this was many moons ago. And so I followed her writing career with great interest and excitement. And so when I was asked to join this conversation, it was really an honor to accept it. So it's wonderful to be here and to have an opportunity to talk about this beautiful, beautiful book. And so I'm going to turn to you now, Lauren. And, you know, I think the best way to walk into or begin a book talk is to really allow the writer to invite us into their world. So perhaps maybe you'd like to start us off with a reading. And will you, if you're so inclined, will you sort of set the table for us?
Sure. this book, thank you, Erica. I'm so thrilled to be talking with you tonight. And happy that you said yes to this, even before you read the book. So. Thrilled. This book is set in the early 1800s and the late 1700s. It's set in two different places in what will become Montana and also in Trinidad. So the book opens with a boy who is the son of a woman who is Trinidadian, and he is a Black boy living among Native Americans at the Crow Native American tribe in Bighorn Mountain, Montana. So it's 1830. Only six of the seven boys saw it, its teasing figure stilled inside a quiet wind. It was as if it wished to be seen, and indeed it was. Between blades of frosty golden grasses, from the branches of a chilled cedar, the boys watched it in the silver light of that cold winter morning, its horns like serrated half moons dying at its muscular jaw, the crackling ice echoing over the thrum of the boys' hearts. They had been told by the elders to bring back all their horses could carry, but the elders did not mean for the boys to hunt everything. Bighorn sheep were not for the taking. This they were told as small lads, and the boys knew well the warning. They'd heard of men who'd killed sheep on the mountain, knew what those men's fates had been. And so the dilemma for the boys that morning was how to ask and answer the hunter's eternal question. Does one from an abundance breed scarcity? So upon this land of shining mountains, each waited for the others, listening for the quickening breath of impatience or the steady sighs of acquiescence. And from the branches of the cedar, Victor searched below for Lykman, who had been the first to mark the ram, the first to outstretch his solid arms and halt the party's movement, signaling for Victor to climb up between the cedar's limbs for a better look. Now Victor counted the heads below. There were only five. The dark, squarish heads with sweeping hair so different from Victor's own were almost indistinguishable from one another. But Lykman's head, now missing in the count, was different. His head cast a perfect oval. This Victor knew, for he had studied Lykman since they were small boys, had watched him grow taller than Victor's reach, observed the muscles in his legs hardening though they'd run the same distances, jumped from the same boulders into the same rivers. As he sat upon the branch, Victor quieted himself, crushing all the wind's words into one long hum, listening for Lykman's thick breaths, the sound of a near man among boys. He found the cracked notes in the tree beside him where he made out Lykman, balanced on the edge of a limb, brushing hair from his eye before steadying his arrow. The boys below began moving about, the skins of their moccasins crunching inside day-old snow, causing the ram to start. Victor watched as Lykman leapt from the tree, his bowed legs like a spider's carrying him over the white terrain while the others looked on, their expressions filled with equal parts terror and awe as Lykman took aim at the sheep, sized like a bear, that now ran so fast and so hard into the distance it seemed it might run itself into the night sky. But then it was as if the ram had come upon a mighty boulder, for it stopped upon its cloven hooves, inside a perfect circle of sunlight with rays so comely and brilliant that they shone on the milky fleece of the ram's rump, as though gifting the forbidden to Lykman. A few months earlier, alongside the mouth of the canyon, Victor sat with the same six boys to begin his first fast. Below them was the sky, painted sapphire blue in a sea of red earth not yet covered in frost, but at the mercy of low diaphanous clouds that lingered like protective mothers. The rock wall behind them, barbed and looming, protected the boys from an early winter's wind, and the rugged peak above them, known as where they see the people, seemed to promise, as it had for generations of boys before, that their visions would soon appear. But several days passed, and while the other boys began to see their box bay, Victor beheld nothing but bigger sky. He maintained his fast, sweated for additional days, prayed with an earnestness and fervor unmatched, and still Victor's vision did not come. And though this should not have been a source of dishonor, Victor could not be convinced that his humiliation was unfounded. Perhaps I had the vision but did not know. Father had laughed with disgrace in his throat, for the other men in the smoke lodge had looked upon them both with quick, sharp glances, reminding them that though it may not have been intended, that they were not of Salakay by blood. Black-skinned, this was how Father described himself. Half black-skinned, half some unknown tribe, Edward Rose was a revered of Salakay war chief who served also as a guide to foreigners. Men who thought themselves explorers, profiteers, compensated Father handsomely to push them beyond the expeditions of Meriwether Lewis and William Clark. And they did so because Edward Rose, though indeed black-skinned, had been with the clan most of his life and was nothing short of Absalike. But Victor's mother's birthright could not be so easily explained. Rosa Rendon was of a far different people, a people she tried once or twice to explain to Victor in clipped phrases, long before he understood he'd need to know of them for his story to be spoken. For Victor, Ma's history began when father brought her to live with the Abseloke after losing his three wives in a horse raid. As it was told, father's next intended had been chosen, a big boned widow from a neighboring clan. But before their introduction, father set off for a year-long expedition, and to the dismay of the clan's women, returned home with a strange woman, more black-skinned than he, who claimed she was born in the middle of a sea on a land she called Trinidad.
Thank you. Just so beautiful. And as I was listening to you, I was thinking about all of the characters mentioned just in that brief introduction. So there's Victor, there's Lightwood, there's Edward, his father, there's Rosa, his mother, and just such a cast of super interesting, very diverse characters. And I'm wondering if you could spend a little time with us talking about how you put these characters in conversation with each other. What was the sort of genesis for the storyline for this beautiful book?
Oddly enough, I was driving to my kid's school and listening to NPR. Willie Nelson was on. He was winning the George Gershwin Prize. And he was strumming his little guitar and singing. And I grew up with West Indian parents who listened to country Western music. And so I didn't immediately like turn the button because I heard Willie singing. I was like, oh, it's Willie. So I listened in and just, you know, it took me back to sitting at home with my parents, watching Westerns, listening to country Western music. Thinking about all the shows we used to watch, and there was just this thought of this girl in this home, and I could see the home that she lived in, and I thought, this is really odd. And the thought just kept coming. You know, I picked up the kids and they got in the car and I thought, all right, this is going to go away like many ideas do, but it just stayed with me and it kept building, and I kept seeing these people. And then I knew I was writing a book in Trinidad, and I was like, wait, horses, land, Trinidad, what is happening here? So I got on, you know, on the internet and decided to see if this was possible. Is it possible that these people could have lived at this time, in this place, in this way? And decidedly, yes. But then I was thinking to myself, I know she has a journey, but I don't know what her journey is. And as I began to do more research, I found Edward Rose, who was a real life character. And Edward was a Crow Native American. He was also half black. And he led many of our, you know, famed explorers out west. And his name didn't come up that much, but there was one book by one historian. And I ordered that book immediately. And when I found him, I knew he was my anchor. He was my person who was going to be the anchor for Rosa when she finally made her way from Trinidad. So it was sort of a beautiful thing to happen.
Now, so you know that I, you know, one of the things that impressed me the most about this book, aside from the beautiful writing, was the amount of history that you cover in this text. And you know that I sort of typically hang out in the late 18th and early 19th century. So anything from that time period always sort of excites me. Can you talk a little bit about what your research process was? Because it's huge. You cover really sort of Trinidad in the late 18th and early 19th century. Then you move to kind of the era of the early Republic and antebellum America, sort of the opening of the West and settlement. It's a lot that you do well.
Yeah, thank you. And I'm not a historian and don't really enjoy the research very much, I have to say. but it's the research that brings the story alive. And you know, being a child of Trinidadians, I found myself just completely fascinated by this early period of the settlement of the island. And I really began with sort of Dr. Eric Williams, who was the first prime minister of Trinidad. He was an Oxford scholar, and he left behind a good number of books about the history of the West Indies, and also specifically about the people of Trinidad and Tobago. And when I began to dig in there, he was giving me like a roadmap of sort of what this island looked like when the Spaniards came, and how long indigenous people fought them, the 200 years that they fought at that time, and how they were able to overcome them eventually, and traded them along the whole Caribbean. And so when I started to realize, I was like, oh, this is history that I didn't even know myself, right? So that makes you want to dig more. And so I began digging more. I went to the University of West Indies, online for the research for the Apsalakes, the Crow Nation. I went out to Montana to Little Bighorn College, and they've got a wealth of information in their library. So really just piecing together, you know, this story. I mean, I had a frame, and I kind of knew what I wanted to happen, but I wasn't sure if it could be done, frankly, without the history, without the research, without realizing that indeed, you know, there's a point where they're traveling from Trinidad to the Americas, and there have to be boats, right, that are going from Trinidad to North America. And so even something as small as, like, why would there be boats going to Mexico? Well, there's a revolution happening. So, you know, people are actually sending goods to support this revolution. And so all those little pieces come together. And it's sort of amazing. It, in some respects, I don't think of the research as being the lead for me. I think of the research as finding what I need, as being the message that I'm on the right path. Ah, you've got something here. Look, you've got this nugget. It's leading you to the next place and the next place. And that is why the research thrills me. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, the research that you, I mean, it's very clear in the text that you did your work. You did your homework. So thank you for historians like myself. We get excited when we read stuff that's accurate and within a beautiful novel. And for me, there were so many strong themes throughout the book. And one of the themes that I think ties the reader to the book is the theme of family. And family really sort of stood out to me when I was reading, really as the tie that binds. And I'm wondering if you could talk just a little bit about family or families that we meet in this book.
Sure. When the book opens, you're meeting Victor, and he is part of this community of people, as I mentioned, on Bighorn Mountain. And his nuclear family is Edward Rose and Rosa Rendon, and he has two sisters. And what's interesting about building the story around Victor is this sense that he is he's a boy who doesn't quite know his past. He doesn't know why he looks different, why his mother looks different, why he's considered to be different. And so the story really takes off because Victor has to figure out who he is, where he comes from. He's got to be grounded in some way, and it's really interfering with his ability to become a man and do his rite of passage as a Native American boy. But it's the family in Trinidad that he knows very little about, and this is the heart of the story, and how his mother becomes this woman who will lead him along this path. And that part of the book begins in 1796, right before the British come and take over the island. And Damas Rendon is the patriarch of this family, and he's a land-owning, free Black man. And the arrival of the British really upset his security. His security as, you know, as a landowner, and his security as a father and a husband in this time. So this family is at the heart of this really interesting time, I think, that that is, you know, causing a lot of upheaval in their lives. And, you know, I think both of my books center around family. I think when I'm writing about people of color in particular, it is hard for me not to think of it as communal. And you know, one of the reasons, I mean, this book is sort of a Western in some respects, but I didn't want to write a Western about rugged individualism. I really wanted to write a Western about community and, you know, and our community with the earth and our community with others who may not actually look like us and be of us, but, you know, finding home and new families in that way. And so, yes, it's definitely a theme that runs through the entire story. There's also a third thread of a kind of a stranger that shows up, and he too is brought into the fold of this community.
And I don't want to give everything away because some people haven't read the book yet, so no spoilers. We'll talk generally about things, but I must say that reading the book, I sort of fell in love with Rosa, that as a character, she meant and represented so much. And I'm wondering if there was an inspiration for Rosa in your writing, or where Rosa comes from, or what Rosa represents for you.
Yeah, you know, I think about the role of women all the time. You know, I have two girls. I think, you know, even for myself, I wonder how my life would have been different, could be different, you know, at a different time where so many expectations and and barriers aren't in place. And, you know, when Rosa popped up in my head, I really wanted her to be, I wanted her to love the land, and I wanted her to be a girl, a farm girl, a horse girl, and she's all these things. She's rugged and she's tough, and, you know, she's got a really strong spirit, but she doesn't live at a time that makes that really easy to be. And I think that's one of the things that comes up very often in the story, is her pushing up against sort of these expectations of what a woman, what a girl is supposed to be. She's supposed to be pretty. She's supposed to be feminine. She's supposed to be domestic, all those things. And Rosa wants none of that. And I really wanted to explore this idea of a girl growing up at this time with all of these demands, you know, much more than we live with now, all these demands for getting married. And, you know, one of the interesting parts of this, the story is about land ownership. And Rosa is the one who cultivates this land. She's the one who understands how the land runs, how the horses are supposed to be taken care of. And yet she's not the one who can inherit this land by law. And that's not only frustrating to her, it's frustrating to her father, who knows that she should be the rightful, possessor of all that he's built. And there's a lot of conflict around her gender in this story.
Yeah, and I think I'm so glad you brought up the land, because I think that's another theme that runs through the book. And in many ways, land is almost maybe multiple characters. Because we're moving, right? So yeah. There's, of course, land in Trinidad, and then there's land in what would be Montana right now. So, I will say I was really impressed by your bravery with this book, because you took on the challenge of writing about a culture that is not your own. And very few people choose to do that or do it successfully. And I believe you have. And I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about why you decided, or how you took on this challenge. coach and how you readied yourself to write about people of Crow descent, people that you are not sort of connected to in familiar ways.
Yeah, yes, you know, I am not Native American, and I'm gonna tell you, it scared the hell out of me. And during the time that I was writing, there's all, you know, all this conversation around appropriation and whether or not we can do this. And, but I was given a very stark choice with this story. I mean, you know, if I decided to write a story about a Black family and this Black woman who's going to make this journey to America during this time, I couldn't do it and erase the fact that there were Native Americans there. I mean, how was that? That seemed more harmful to me than anything. And I've been a reader of novels where that's happened. And I'm thinking to myself, how is it possible that I could read a 500 page book set in New York City and not one character is a character who looks like me? I mean, and it happens over and over again, and I didn't want to do that, right? And so I decided that if I'm going to do this, I have to have a reason for why I'm doing it. And I knew, and I also had to focus my, I had to focus on the fact that I was speaking about a Black girl, a Black woman, you know, moving along, and she is a part of this greater community. So the question really then became, how am I going to do this in a way that honors and respects another culture that I don't know intimately? So I went there. I researched. I had a wonderful Crow gentleman who's also, you know, a writer, who said to me, I will hold your hand and help you through this. I respect that this is what you want to do, and I want you to get it right. And so I'm eternally grateful for him helping me through this process. And he you know, he helped me with my blind spots, because I knew that I had blind spots. But, you know, approaching anything like this requires a lot of humility. And I hope that I approached it with humility. I also approached it in a way where I kept reminding myself that this is how I would want someone to do it for me, for my culture, for if they were writing about, you know, a Black woman, a Black girl, a Trinidadian, whatever that is, I would want that kind of attention. So, I think that I try to respect. I tried to give a lot of love and respect in the way that I would want it to be done. And I don't know if I'm, I thank you for saying I was successful at it. I, you know, it leaves me feeling breathless sometimes, but I knew I couldn't do otherwise.
Well, I you know, I think we see your care and your thoughtfulness in through your characters, and you know, sort of back to Rosa. You know, Rose is a way that we travel, right? There's in many ways she's our guide through that time period, and she takes us kind of everywhere. At least we go with her, including to this community of people who were very present at this moment, and it's a sort of seamless connect, at least. The way you've written it, it is seamless. And when I was sort of thinking about our conversation today, I wanted to ask you a question that someone sometimes asks me. And I wanted to know if there was a character that was difficult for you to write.
Who would be the character? You know, I think that I had the most challenge with Victor, who is a 12-year-old boy. And and particularly because I think that I fell into the trap of thinking of him as a sort of modern day 12-year-old boy. And this is where Scott, who I mentioned earlier, the Crow Native American gentleman who helped me, he reminded me that a boy at this age and this community was almost a fully realized man in many respects. He was strong. He could hunt. He really knew how to take care of himself. So there were moments where I found myself, I don't know, sort of babying this character in ways that, you know, he didn't deserve to be babied. And yet I also wanted to tap into that emotional side, because despite the fact that he is physically strong and can take care of himself and be out in the world in a physical way, he's still a boy. And no matter what year it is, you know, our development is our development. And so I wanted to be able to tap into the emotional side of this boy. And so the two, that was a little bit of a strange balance to strike for me. But I think I kept reminding myself that there were two sides of him in the same way that, you know, we're all complex characters. I want him to be fully realized in a really complex way for a boy at this time.
Well, I want us to keep talking, but I want to remind folks who are joining in virtually that you will have the opportunity to ask a question. And so if you look towards the bottom of your screen, there's an ask a question box that you can click and write in a question. And I will do my best to moderate those questions. And so I wanted to give you a little bit of time to think about that as Lauren and I sort of wrap up our conversation. And I, you know, this book tells a very sort of long and painful and often violent narrative of European colonization. I mean, that is, we can't sort of separate ourselves from that when we're reading this novel. And not just colonization, but also the racism that comes along with it. And it's, to me, it was really a story about finding freedom for both Black and brown people, for women who really were living through some of the most difficult situations. And one of the beautiful things about this book is that you tell us how people live and love and sometimes thrive under really kind of oppressive conditions. And can you talk a little bit about how you bring the triumph and tragedy together?
Yeah, thank you. So I think in any narrative that I set out to write, I try to remind myself, I mean, you know, let me go back a second. When I was reading Eric Williams' books, and you know, he had documents of the West Indies, there were a lot of letters written by colonists back home to Europe. You know, how things were going, how hard things were. You know, and there were census documents. You know, naming owners and property, and then the number of colored people and the number of enslaved Africans, you know, and every time I came across that census material, I kept thinking to myself, these are real people, right? They have stories. And what I hoped to do was to bring out, just pluck out one of those families and just show that, like, these people were real, fully realized human beings who owned land, sometimes were enslaved, you know, the different facets, but they were people who experienced pain and joy. And so bringing that together seemed fundamental for me to this story. Just being able to really show that despite the travails, despite the hardship, that in the end, we're always seeking better. We're seeking more freedom. And, you know, and that's really Rosa's story. I mean, Rosa is, she set out to look for a better life for herself and for her family. And she, the one thing I love about her as a character is that she keeps going. Mm-hmm. You know, she keeps going. She's and you know, it may not seem like, I don't know if she would describe it as joy, but she knows what she's, what she wants, and she wants to look out onto a piece of land and to say, this is my space, these are my people, and not to be interrupted by that again, in the way that, you know, she was interrupted when you know, life is thrown in Trinidad.
Yeah, yeah. And that's, you know, I think what I'll do is I'll check in with our, with folks and remind them that now is the time to type in your questions if you have anyone or have any questions or comments, and I'll read them. And while our audience is responding, I'll ask another question, or rather put this out there as something that I was thinking about when reading the book. The read for me was very physical. I felt like it reminded me of the physicality of life in the 19th century. So when we think about cooking a meal, when we think about washing laundry, these are things that are actually quite laborious, quite physical, collecting water, running after or hunting food, and then skinning it and preparing it, and the amount of time that it took. And it was, like I said, it was physical. And it also sort of reminded me, there are moments in this text where I'm thinking about illness, because there are moments when your characters have to confront or engage with illness, which in the 19th century was disastrous. And of course, at this moment, the specific moment in time, I'm thinking about illness and physicality of everything. Was that something that you spent a great deal of time thinking about as you were writing?
Yeah, you know, I have a grandmother who died, you know, early in life, and what we think she died of is a burst appendix, and I too had a burst appendix, you know, back in when my children were very young, and I think about that all the time. I think about the difference in how I made it and she didn't. And so when you talk about illness, I'm often struck by what we, you know, the diseases, the afflictions that we have today, and how we're able to continue to live and thrive despite them. But these illnesses are not new. And what did that mean at this time? And so that question is always in the back of my mind, always. How did women deal with menstruation? I really try
birth.
How do they deal with birth? I mean, I try really hard to not gloss over the difficulties of life for women particularly, but also you know, just what everyday life feels like, what it feels like to have a belly ache, what it feels like to fall out of a tree. You know, what does that mean for your life at this time, when there are no hospitals, where there are, you know, no antibiotics, where you're just, you know, hoping that someone makes it through. You know, so yeah, so I think that, but you know, generally in terms of physicality, when I'm writing, I write, I'm very visual, so I need to see what color the leaves are on the trees, and I need to see what, you know, what's blooming, and so I am really trying to put a reader into a place, and you know, what I hope to do is to make a book very immersive, where you're in this world and in this time, and you know exactly what everything looks like and feels like, and hopefully not in a very heavy way, but just in a way that allows you to experience it in you know, in all your senses.
Well, I'm going to turn to your audience questions. And the first one says, hi, Lauren, Craig here, it's Craig Smith.
Hi.
If you're comfortable doing so, can you talk about how you talk about your work with your daughters and what they tell you back?
Thanks, Craig, for that really difficult question. I do talk about a little bit with them, but you know, they're also 13 and 15, and they're really into their own lives, and mommy's books are not that interesting to them. But you know, what I find though is that I do tend to begin, if I have a child in the story, I tend to be focused really on the ages that my children are at the time. Mm-hmm. And that really informs me in so many ways, just how they move, what, you know, how their bodies are. You know, there's so many, the things that they say. So even if I'm not directly conversing with them about the book, I am using them in some respects to remind myself of what it means to embody, you know, a little person's life at various stages. We meet Rosa when she's a young girl. She's 9 years old when we first meet her in Trinidad, and we watch her, you know, turn into a young woman, and then we see her as an adult woman later. And we also meet Victor at 12, and it's no surprise that, you know, my kids were about that age. My oldest was about that age when I started writing this story.
All right, so the next question. Hi, Lauren, could you talk about what was the most surprising thing you learned from the research while working on this book? And what did you learn about yourself?
That's a good question. You know, and this didn't necessarily make it into the book per se, but when my mom went with me to Montana the last time we went, just to kind of clean up all the research. And we had two wonderful Crow Native American, a couple who, you know, took us up their mountain and really showed us the land. And so I was stunned by the beauty of that land, just awed by it. I mean, really awed by it. And I've been to really beautiful places, but that ranks pretty darn high. But while I was with them, you know, they talked a lot about the discrimination that they faced, even today in everyday life living in Montana. And I thought I was pretty aware, but I was actually really stunned by the stories that they shared with me about what they face day to day. And so, you know, and I say that it didn't make it into the book, but in some respects, you know, there's a character that inhabits, he inhabits Native American identity, and he deals with that a little bit. Anyway, I think that was, for me anyway, that was pretty shocking. And what did I learn about myself? this book seemed really, really, when it first came, when I mentioned that this Willie Nelson story, and I was thinking about it, I was like, are you kidding me? I'm not writing this. This is nuts. Like, it just felt epic and huge. And I was really scared to sit down and try this book. I mean, the way that it lays itself out and feels really complex, the structure of it. And I was scared to do this. I thought I'm just gonna fall flat on my face with this one. So, you know, I think I learned maybe that I'm not such a bad writer.
You are not, you are great. wonderful. So our next question from the audience. Would you talk about balancing the research with the fiction and turning the former into the latter?
Yeah, that's always a big issue for me. Even as a reader, I don't want to feel like I can see the work of the research when I'm reading, unless I'm reading nonfiction, right? But when I'm reading fiction, I just want it to be very seamless. So as you can imagine, I have thousands of pages of things I could put into this book, little nuggets here and there, but you know. Trying to make it not so heavy and just to put in the slightest bit of information. So, you know, there's a scene where Rosa's going hunting with her father. And you know, I had to do a little research about kind of deer in Trinidad. Are there deer in Trinidad? Like, you know, yes, there are deer in Trinidad, but they're a different kind of deer. And then I kind of went down this rabbit hole of like, oh, well, you know, what do these deer look like? Do I describe the deer? But all I really needed to do was to just sort of use the research to sort of explain like why this deer hunting scene was challenging for Rosa and her father and why they needed to be out together alone for this extended period of time. And so I was creating a bond and I used the research to kind of do that. So, you know, the rutting season for deer in Trinidad and how they would hunt in the tropics for an animal like that is completely different than how they would do it in North America. And so so little moments like that help buoy the story of people for me.
Okay, so this is from Ashley. She says, "Hi, Lauren. I'm just wondering what current authors inspire you. Go Quakers, another member of the class of 94.
Oh, thanks. Current authors. I love Arundhati Roy. I love Zadie Smith. And just thinking about people who are sort of publishing, I'm reading a book now by Regina Porter called The Travelers. There's a really interesting like history that she's delving into. So, you know, I love Dolan Perkins Valdez, what she did with Wench, the historical fiction. Bernice McFadden, Praise Song for the Butterflies. I mean, you know, she goes to Ghana and, you know, and just, there's just such, there's so many great women writers who I'm reading, who I love. And I guess I take a little bit from, of inspiration from every one of them. I'm a big believer that like certain books find you at the right time. And so, anything that I read during this writing just influenced me in so many ways. So,
all right, another comment or question. You invested a great deal of work in creating this book. How long did it take to write this book from the initial idea through completion?
4 years. 4 years. From the moment, I wasn't quite sure, but I went back to see when that NPR show aired. And so I think it's in about 4 years. And that does not include the sort of editing, a little bit of the editing that comes, in the second go around, those slight edits, but just about 4 years, which felt sort of fast given the heft of this book. But when this book came, it really just came. I mean, I knew what was going to happen from sort of I knew the beginning and the middle and the end. So I always think of this as a gift, almost like I was just a conduit for this story.
Can you talk a little bit about what is your writing process like? I'm sorry, I butt in the line. Everybody's got questions, but do you write every day? Do you write in blocks of time? Do you do word counts? Like how do you write?
Yeah. No, I wish I could write every day, but you know, I've got like children and carpool and homework to help with. So, I, you know, and I remember I ran into Bernice McFadden years ago at a conference, and I felt so guilty and bad about not writing every day. And I said, you know, do you write every day? Like, how do you do it? And she was like, girl, please, no. You know, you. I was like, thank God. And it really gave me permission to like have blocks of time. So ultimately I drop off the kids and I come back home and I sit down and, you know, and I'm really trying to push through until I have to pick them up, you know, with a break to walk the dog. But that's it. And, you know, and there are days when I just can't get to it, but they're also those days if I'm washing the dishes or I'm, you know, doing some annoying chore that I have to do, I'm also thinking about it and I'm thinking about what the next scene is going to be. And I keep it suspended and I just keep visualizing it and visualizing it until I can get back to the computer. And that's been really helpful. I mean, my first book, I started when my kids were 2 and 4. And that was the only way that I could have written that book is to just keep reminding myself of what that next scene was going to look like. So when I sat down, I would just hit the ground running.
All right, I'll go back to the queue. And maybe I'll take, we'll take two more questions. This says, hello, Lauren. Were any of the medicinal herbs and teas depicted in the novel pulled from your family's Trinidadian heritage? That was from Michelle Fling.
Oh, hi, Michelle. a little. So, you know, it's really interesting because I think that when you're growing up, you don't really realize that, you know, that your grandmother's giving you something that you don't know what it is that she's actually giving you. So, you know, just drink this. And as I got older, I started to realize, oh, right, this was, you know, this is a laxative or this is a blah, blah, blah. And before you know it, you start to incorporate these things in your life as well. And so so there was a little bit of that. There's also a scene where the Rose's oldest sister, you know, does this thing with the egg yolk, and I won't give too much away, but she does this thing with an egg yolk. And I was getting my car repaired, and I was talking to a Jamaican woman who was, you know, describing doing this exact scene. And I was like, would you mind if I use this scene in my book? And she worked at the front desk, and I was just chatting with her, and I wrote that thing down. And so I was gathering up all kinds of interesting remedies and medicinal herbs from lots of sources. And some of those sources I did research on Native American and what they used as well. And so I used that in those scenes in Montana and Idaho.
So let's see, this is from Dana Lynch. Hi, Lauren, are you currently working on another book or have a concept you want to explore? If so, can you tell us about it? Go figures.
Hi, Dana. Yes. So before this book, before Willie Nelson and NPR, I was working on another book that I intended to sell next. And this book came completely crashing in. And that book, which I'm almost finished, is set in the 1920s and early 1920s and set in Baltimore, about a young girl. And I'll leave it at that.
Well, I'm gonna do maybe one more question. We'll see. I'm looking at the clock here. So this is a comment question. I haven't read this book yet, but it sounds really interesting. So go down to the little thing where you can click and buy from Joseph Fox, the wonderful bookseller, connected to the library. Okay. The question is, I was wondering, at what stage do you begin to show your work to an agent or a publisher? In other words, when do you know it's ready?
Yeah, I actually mess that up all the time. I tend to show a little too early because I'm like, oh, it's done. And then I push it off, you know, to my agent. And she's like, nope, not done. You need to have a little more time. And so, So I'm not very good at that, but I have found, and this is weird because this wasn't something that I did very early on, but now that I feel more confident as a writer, I tend to give it to good readers, you know, friends who are in my circle, my husband, who really is a very good reader for me. And they'll tell me, yeah, I kind of got this, I kind of got that. So I think trusting other people before you send it out to an agent is the best advice I can give. You don't want to mess up your first time sending something out to a publisher or an agent. Like you want it to be so, so right that the moment someone else reads it, they're like, I don't have much to tell you. You know?
So when you're choosing who to send it out to, your girls, your friends, your other writer friends, like how do you make that decision?
Well, you know, I didn't become a writer in the traditional way. So I don't really have a lot of writer friends, to be honest with you. So I kind of have a lot of lawyer friends. I choose people who I've been in book clubs with, and I think that they're really good readers, because I'm not looking for the technical stuff. I just want to know, is this gripping you? Like, are you able to turn the page and you want to turn the page? How does this character resonate with you? So my questions are so much more broad, and they're about feelings. And, does this give you the feeling that I'm hoping you'll have?
And the last comment, is happy belated birthday, Lauren.
Thank you.
And what a wonderful way to spend your birthday, right? To be able to talk about something that you've labored over for years and you've birthed, right? And now it's out in the public. And I have to thank you for such a wonderful novel. That, as I said, it kept me up, but I'm glad that I missed that sleep. And thank you for bringing this beautiful work of art to us at this specific moment.
Oh, thank you, Erica. Thank you so much for doing this with me. I'm so happy that you're here. Thank you.
Well, I want to thank both of you very much, and happy birthday, Lauren. And I can't think of a better birthday present from all the people watching than if they bought a copy of the book. So thank you very much for immersing us in the world of the Book of the Little Axe. And to our viewers at home, I want to remind you to follow us on Crowdcast and visit us at the Free Library at freelibrary.org/author events to access our online archives and updated event schedule, which changes, it seems, all of the time. Thanks again. Keep reading, and everyone have a good night.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/author events.